Hello, listeners, and welcome back to Black in Boston and Beyond, a podcast of the Trotter Institute at UMass Boston. I'm Hetty V. Williams, your host. Today on Black in Boston and Beyond, we have Dr. Rob Eshman, Associate Professor of Social Work and a member of the Data Science Institute at Columbia University, as well as faculty associate at Harvard's Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society. He is also the author of When the Hood Comes Off, Racism and Resistance in the Digital Age, published by the University of California Press. Welcome to the show, Rob.
Thank you so much, Hetty. I'm really happy to be here.
Thank you for joining me today and to talk about your great book, which is so important. I really enjoyed reading it, and I hope our listeners will too. And I'm sure they will just by the topic alone, race in the digital age, such an important conversation in the history of the African diaspora that also touches on the Boston region that we'll also try to incorporate into our larger conversation. But first, we want to discuss Rob's research and background and maybe what led him to write this book, When the Hoods Come Off. Tell us a little bit about your research and teaching interests.
Yeah. So broadly speaking, I'm interested in studying race, education, and technology. And in recent years, that has been for me writing about the ways that technology changes how we experience, understand, and respond to racism. And, you know, all that research has culminated in my book, When the Hood Comes Off, which, you know, I tell a comprehensive story that starts out on the college campus and how students and students of color are experiencing changes in the way race is talked about and the way they experience racism. And then also, you know, expands to the broader internet space, looking at social media data for over a decade. And so, you know, it really is an engaging and very relevant conversation about how, you know, race is changing now. And you know, these changes are happening every day. And I think that people are experiencing and understanding race in a new way now than they may have a decade or so ago.
And I know one of my questions, hopefully we get to all of these questions, was about the post-racial. And we often think of ourselves, oh, we are in the, you know, modern or postmodern moment in which we are post-racial. But that's the myth of a post-racial society is something hopefully we get to talk about, too. But many of our listeners are college students, professors, faculty members around the world. And so I always like my guests to talk a little bit about their own journey into college and selecting a major, which you incorporate into the book, right? You talk about this conversations that you're having with your own, family members and friends on the college campus and so on. So did you come to college knowing what your major would be? Was it a particular experience that led you to study digital media and race? Tell us a little bit about that journey.
I absolutely did not know what I wanted to study when I went to college. It's funny, you know, my last semester of college, the max number of credits you could take at my university was 18. And then I took an additional two or three classes from a junior college that I needed just to graduate. And the reason I was behind is because my first year in college, I was skipping all the gen eds. I didn't want to take, you know, the basic history and the basic biology classes. I was taking things that interested me, like philosophy of the arts and, you know, music composition, even though I am not a musician. I was just so excited about having such a wide range of classes. So I had absolutely no idea. For a while I was, flirting with, you know, creating a proposal to do my own major that was a mix of philosophy, sociology and, music. And then I ended up, changing to sociology. And for me, I think that moving to sociology, it had to do with, I wanted to be a teacher. I think that I have long had a belief in education as being a way of trying to combat racial inequality. I was actually in high school when I read the book Savage Inequalities by Jonathan Kozol, which talked about, funding disparities between Black and white schools and how we could predict future racial inequality by educational inequality. And so, I think that I was very interested in being part of the solution to this problem that has been durable across many generations. And I switched to being a sociology major from thinking about being a teacher, right? I'm sorry. You know what? I'm muddying the things here. I think I missed out on saying that after looking at philosophy and things like that, trying to make my own major, I was going to be an English major. And I ended up kind of one credit away from an English minor because I wanted to teach English in high school, right? So I wanted to be a teacher. I moved to sociology when I decided that doing research on education and education reform might be more impactful than being a teacher for myself and for, what my own goals and hopes for being part of the reform struggle would be. And so that's what led me to my major. That's a long story there, right? But, this is something that these are years that I remember. These are very formative years. And I think that I, like many college students, had no idea what I wanted, what exactly I wanted to do, what job I wanted to have. But I knew things I was passionate about and I knew areas that I wanted to, hopefully have an impact on.
No, I think it's a good point to make, especially with so many college students listening to the show. I changed my major 3 times. I think at the end of sophomore year, I settled on history, but I had so many interests in English literature. I was a humanities person because I went from art to English to history. So it's a common story, I think, that many students entering college have, what do I want to do?
Yeah.
But what in particular, you do tell this story early in the book. What in particular made you want to study race and the digital age? You talk about these different episodes early on that sort of guided your focus on race.
Yeah. So I tell the story in the book about the first time I was called the N-word and how, that happened while I was playing online video games. And that was just
right.
I knew what racism was. I was very familiar with racism, but I had never been called the N-word maliciously like that. I grew up in a neighborhood that, was majority Black and Latinx and just was not something that happened, where I grew up. This happened over winter break. And when I came back to campus, I began wondering if this is something that happened, right? And it was something that happened often. It was like every time you put on the headset and play, the N-word is getting thrown around. And so it made me wonder, do some of my white friends who I play video games with on campus speak like that when I'm not around, when we're all on break, playing in our own separate worlds behind anonymous usernames? And so that was not something that drove me to want to study digital media. It was just, a question in the back of my head is like, wow, what is this? Tell us about society and racism being hidden in places where people want to say, right? You mentioned post-racial earlier, where people want to believe that the world is post-racial, but then you have incidents like that to show like, no, maybe it's there, but it's just not in your face the same way that it was. And then that gives us a reason to want to interrogate and investigate, where is racism hiding? What does racism look like in a world where people typically don't want to be openly racist. And so for me that, right. I did not go to grad school to study digital racism, but when I got to grad school and I began learning about, the dominant theories of racism, pointing to the way that it has become more subtle in the years since the classic civil rights movement, right? Racism is illegal. Now you can't be racist without getting fired from your job or getting in trouble in school. And just this idea that racism has changed and it just made me interested in exploring the contradiction between what I was learning, these theories and these books that I have so much respect for, and then my own personal experiences and knowing that online that isn't right, that you do not have subtle expressions of racism. Racism can be more in your face. And so, you know, I think that that led to me doing more reading, doing more thinking. I wrote my qualifying exams. I included this as a question of, you know, wanting to explore how the internet changes the way people talk about race. And so I think that, that for me, this study, began as a way of trying to understand, something that, that seemed to be, you know, in conflict with each other, that on one hand, the racism is more subtle, on the other hand, it's not, in a different context. And so what is it about that context that changes how people really do racism, and how do experiences with this new, or I guess we could call it old, if it's becoming more overt, which is something we expected during Jim Crow, how do those experiences shape the way that people think about the world, and the way that they respond to racism?
Yeah, that's the, I think, a real core of your book that just has me fascinated, that you say post civil rights, but folks are, I mean, especially, I don't have a question about Trump on here particularly, but that, I mean, folks feel, you know, emboldened to be able to walk out the door and call somebody and get in their face like they did in the Jim Crow South, mm-hmm. You know, almost as if it's like, hey, it's okay to say what you want to say.
Yeah, yeah. I think that things are definitely changing now. And in the book, I definitely talk about Trump and this seeming, reversal from what has been the norm. I think that with Trump, there is not a huge difference between Trump's policies and other conservative policies. The difference is more in his language, that he was a little bit more open, in his prejudices and the way that he would get up and talk at a, you know, at official, political events, it sounded like the way that he would talk on Twitter. And so this type of language that was normalized in online spaces and in social media is something that he brought to the rallies, and people liked it. And I think that that has had a lasting change on the way that lots of conservative politicians engage with the public, where they feel like they may get more donations and may get some of that Trump fan base if they present themselves as also being anti-establishment, as being not afraid to say what many people are thinking. And so I definitely think that Trump has changed the game, but I also don't think that we can analyze Trump's, differences and the changes that he's brought without thinking about the role that technology has played in facilitating different, types of audiences and communities and different comfort levels with, more explicit expressions of racism.
Yeah, I teach this course. I've taught this course for probably over a decade, called Urban Legends. And in one of the segments, we look at, social media and really looking at the internet as a way, or the use of social media as a way to kind of spread urban legends, right? Mm-hmm. And looking at it as a locus of oral culture, where people obviously use a kind of different language than they would in person, right? And it's kind of circulating these stories and legends using the internet and social media in a particular way, or even sharing a chain mail through email, right? And you say, well, wait a minute, that's folk culture, right? And so in some ways, Trump kind of revives, right? That's sort of the folk hero kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Where he uses a particular type of language and says what he wants and doesn't use correct, grammar and speaks his mind, and all of that on Twitter and social media.
Yeah.
Yeah. Was born.
Yeah. No, I think that's absolutely right. Now, one of the things I talk about in the book is that I feel that invisibility is one of racism's strongest tools, that when racism can hide, then, we can't point out the ways that it's working. So in my view, I think that in the long term, this kind of push towards being more openly racist is going to end up being a problem for the right when more and more people are able to recognize what racism looks like. And I already think that that's some, you know, that's beginning to happen. I think when you look at the high voting turnout for Biden in the last election, it wasn't rather we have people voting in record-breaking numbers, but not because Biden is a popular candidate. It was because people were trying to get rid of Trump. And I think that Trump's being more open and overt. Right. You think about conservative politicians traditionally have used dog whistles to have code words where they're letting people know, hey, this is the racist policy, support it, without having to be openly racist. And Trump's dog whistle was, you know, audible to everyone. And I think that, you know, made him popular and helped him in some ways. But I also think that it encouraged folks to, you know, jump on the anti-Trump side of things, and because they saw him as being, you know, so distasteful and so far away from where they hoped the world would be, now. And so I think that this is something that we're in a moment where there seems to be a pendulum swing, in the wrong direction, right? The decisions that are being made by the Supreme Court, policies that are happening in Florida. But right, when we look at these policies, why is it that they don't want us to learn? Why don't they want kids to learn about race in school? It's because the more kids that understand racism, the more kids are going to want to fight against racism. And if they can perpetuate this myth that slavery wasn't bad and that diversity isn't good, then you're going to have, right, or what they would want is that they want to have people who want they want adults who believe those things instead of adults who understand racism as a problem and then begin to look for solutions to racism. Mm-hmm. I think that you know, these types of behaviors and policies are very disturbing. But you know, my hope is that they would wake us up to realize, like, oh, some of the work that we're doing to talk about racism more is being effective because it's scaring them enough that they want to create laws against it. And that tells us something about the way that racism works.
I think you mentioned a few really good points here. Education and learning. In order for fascism to work, you have to destroy, right, people's minds. You got to take over the schools, the airwaves, right?
Exactly.
In order that's the one of the pillars, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we can see, like, with these book banning and all of these different motives and, you know, this is another show, but in terms of who's behind all of that, right? Trying to take over higher education and banning books and so forth. Like, what's the money behind all of it? But since you mentioned education, critical race theory, and what we want people to learn and not to learn, and kind of using that sort of, I don't want my child learning this in fifth grade, mm-hmm. right? So you mentioned critical race theory. You bring it up anyway in the earlier part of the book. But tell us, can you kind of debunk a little bit of it, though? Is critical race theory being taught to a kindergartner?
No, it's not. Critical race theory. So it's a theory that was developed by legal scholars to better understand how, after the victories of the classic civil rights movement, we weren't seeing we were still seeing it, you know, increased racial inequality, and really trying to understand how race neutral policies and laws were still perpetuating racial inequality. And so really it's just a framework for understanding the ways that racism is embedded in our laws and our institutions in friendly colorblind interactions. There's nothing dangerous about it. It just highlights racism. The idea that kids are being taught it, like, no, this is something that is usually taught to grad students, maybe some advanced, you know, sociology majors may learn about it. But it's definitely not being taught at elementary schools. It's really being used now as kind of a buzzword or a code word for anything that is race related or diversity related, that they're saying, right? Like if a textbook is trying to teach about why racism is bad, they're going to put that under the umbrella term of critical race theory. And this is why, you know, I reference in the book some of these comedic videos of folks going and interviewing people who are fighting against critical race theory in schools, asking them what it is, and none of them can answer it. And so, like, they're saying, oh, this is evil. This is, you know, they're brainwashing our kids, but they have no idea what the theory is. And right. And so, you know, there are different ways you can interpret that. On one hand, you could think, okay, are there some well-meaning people out there who are anti-critical race theory because they actually think it's bad? Like maybe there are some of those. But I also think the people who are behind this push are people who want us to stop thinking and talking about racism so that we can continue to live in a world where white supremacy is the way that the world works. And so I think that it is an intentional silencing of a framework that can expose the way that racism works. I think that because there may be people who are actually fooled, part of our work as educators or activists or anti-racists is going to be to debunk these popular ideas about things like critical race theory and why they're not going to be harmful to kids. But right, there's nothing to be lost by teaching kids the realities of the world and history.
And it's also, like you said, it's also a way to, for the right to attack not only K through 12 education, but higher education simultaneously.
Yeah.
There's a mother walking around saying, oh, I don't want this taught in kindergarten. Oh, I don't want it taught to my child where I'm paying this $50,000 tuition either. So it's, the right is very, I mean, they're savvy at using these sound bites and these words and phrases. It's to scare folks.
Yeah, it's interesting to see that, right? Like, are we at a place where we're potentially going to lose, you know, academic freedom of speech, where professors are being told they can't teach certain things? That's a dangerous world to live in. And I think I think that this is something that we really need to reflect on, is that, right, why is it, right, for folks who may be on the right? And I think when I think about these things, I like to assume that there are good people on the right. There are good people who want the best for themselves and their families. And if we want to, you know, recruit folks to the side of anti-racism, how would we explain it to someone who is not, does not hate folks of color, but then they are trapped in a way of thinking that is, you know, perpetuating racist outcomes? So, right. I think that gives us a challenge of how do we explain what's happening with these processes to people who may legitimately be fooled by conservative pushes to ban, you know, discussions of race or ban professors from doing research and writing and teaching about racism in schools. It's a scary moment to be in.
Sure, especially to be a teacher, an educator, well, to be human. I think fascism is a threat to humanity.
Yeah, yeah.
Regardless.
Yeah, that's true. And right, like I think I teach in New York, and I don't think New York is in danger of going the way of Florida. But right, I have colleagues who are in Florida, and these decisions are impacting their everyday life right now. Right, there's questions of is tenure going to be respected, or right, are they going to get rid of tenure? And so this is something that, you know, professors, this is just, you know, this is just one job, and it's, you know, there's changes that are affecting many people in society. But it's the right, like, this is, we're in a time where that we have real things to fight for that are going to impact our future.
Texas, I mean, I can just think off the top of my head, Texas and Georgia, you know, if they have anything to say about it, you know, they have this push to get rid of tenure, and will that spread across the country, right? We're in the Northeast, so we say to ourselves, is that even possible? But you have like similar laws, I think, in 40 plus states that, will they, you know, actually get this done? There's a lot of money behind it. But let's turn more directly to your book and talk about this title. I like this title, When the Hoods Come Off. I like the title and tie it to your main premise for us. Break it down for us as briefly as you can.
Yeah, yeah. So the title, When the Hood Comes Off, Racism and Resistance in the Digital Age. I talk about the theme. Those themes in, you know, early in chapter one were, right, like, what is the hood, right? The cover image of the book is a KKK hood. And then at the bottom, you have folks who are protesting. And so I really wanted to show images of both racism and resistance, because, right, that a big part of this book is not just about how online communication is changing racism. It's about how it's changing the fight against racism. And that is, you know, the part that I find the most hopeful and the most inspiring. But for me, right, when we think about what does the hood represent, it may be the most emblematic, you know, symbol of racism in the U.S. And that what did the hood allow people to do? It allowed everyday barbers, teachers, policemen, clergy members to put on a hood and to engage in domestic terrorism against Black citizens without their identities being revealed. So that anonymity protected them and you know, from facing the consequences of their actions. And one thing I talk about is that in the years following the end of Jim Crow with the classical civil rights movement, racism has been hiding behind a more metaphorical hood of subtlety, where racism has become more subtle. It's hidden, and subtlety hides racism from the general public the way that a hood hid the identity of someone who's engaging in acts of racism. That, right, again, going back to you talking about this idea of a post-racial society, that many people legitimately believe that we are in a post-racial society because racism is so subtle. It's so hidden inside of everyday interactions and institutions and policies. And so when the hood comes off is referring to what I call the unmasking of racism in digital spaces, where racism is revealed to people who may not have understood how it worked in a society that they thought had defeated racism 75 years ago. And so When the Hood Comes Off is a book about the way that technology is unmasking racism, revealing it to the world, and you know, putting it right by unmasking it, it allows us to fight it in different ways. And so it's about, racism being unmasked and racism being resisted in new and innovative and unique ways that I think are shifting the balance of power and really make many folks of color feel like they have more capacity to fight back against racism.
And I like that it's really a book in two parts, right? Where you talk about, you know, this sort of blatant racism when you were playing the video games, and then people and young people resisting, right? It's a story of resistance too. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, an important part of the conversation. But you know, mentioning race theory and race studies and race applied to the understanding of digital media, what interventions do you see your book making in this field that has, you know, expanded tremendously with the rise of the internet and social media?
Yeah. Yeah. Do you mean theoretical interventions?
Sure. Theoretical interventions, race studies, writ large, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think, you know, so it's funny because the field, when I first started, is very different than the field now. And I think one of the things, right, when I was reading, about race and technology when I first began the study and began thinking about these things, is that most research was done only with on things that happened online. So people are analyzing online forums, online comments, online blogs, and that all the data came from online spaces, which I think is great and which gives us helps us build a full understanding of how race talk, or what race talk looks like online. But one thing I wanted to do is I wanted to understand the impact of online race talk on, you know, people. On, right, how does this impact people in the real world, right? And so what I did when I designed the study is I do take some data from some online forums, but then I wanted to talk to people about how they use social media, how they experience race in person, how they experience race online. I really wanted to understand the differences, if any, between racial discussions online and in person. And I wanted to understand how racism online affected people and the ways that they thought about race and racism in their everyday lives. And so I think that's one of the things I do methodologically that's that is new and innovative and unique, is that I combine data from multiple sources, where I have interviews with more than 80 students from around the country. In Los Angeles, Atlanta, Chicago, Boston, and New York. I have some survey data that I reference, but you know that's not essential to the book. And then I also have analysis of a decade's worth of you know tweets, millions of tweets, looking at keywords over a long period, doing some qualitative analysis of social media data, but then also doing some long-term trend analysis of social media data. And so I think combining these multiple sources is unique in the field, that it has not been done at this at this scope. And so they're right, that is something that's very unique and allows me to really tell a more comprehensive story of not just about what race talk looks like online, but how online communication is changing the way that we all experience and talk about and understand race and racism. Beyond that,
I think it's real. The mixed methods is really brilliant. It's getting at the problem, the issue, in ways that nobody else really has. You know, I appreciate the method so much.
Thank you. Yeah, you know, it took me. It's interesting because I wrote my dissertation on this subject, but I only had interviews from one school, and I really wanted to expand the study before I wrote the book. And so first I went out and I got interviews from other schools. I wanted to see, hey, are the things that I found unique to this one school, or is it going to be replicated in other cities? And then, right, I went out and I got some survey data because I wanted to know what is the impact of experiencing racism online on mental health. So I got that survey data. And then I went out and I got the social media data because I wanted to understand how some of the processes that I was finding qualitatively, you know, fit with what was happening in a broader sense online. I didn't just want to write a book about social media changing racial discussions on college campuses. I wanted to talk about social media changing, you know, racial discussions around the, in society in general. So it was very intentional. It was very systematic, but I also, took great care to write this in a way that it does not read like an academic book, that I'm not reporting. I'm not simply reporting, data and findings from academic study, but I am talking about this in a conversational and engaging way to try and communicate, ideas that can be heavy, theories that can be complex in ways that are, can be understood by, folks who do not study these things for a living. And so it was important for me to make this a book that is accessible to the general public.
Yes, I think appreciate that you brought that up because it is definitely very accessible and it's not heavy with jargon, and that's different for somebody in race studies and theories and all these different methods, right? It's many times it's weighted down with jargon, but this is a very accessible book. That's a great point you make there, that it is and can be used and read by a very vast public, not just, assigned to a classroom. It can be assigned. It can be, used in both ways, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I think it would be very useful in a classroom. But then, I did want to make sure that it's also would be interesting for people outside of academia. And, I'm thankful that feedback I've gotten so far is that, that did come through, that lots of people have read it and felt like, oh, wow, this is helping me, grow and understand things in a different and more complex way, but also is something that was fun to read and is enjoyable. I think I'd like to, I mix in a lot of personal narratives and personal stories in there to try and illustrate points that I think are kind of data driven, so the book is rigorous and data driven, but it is not academic reporting. So I think that those are ways or contributions that I'm making to the field. I am very excited about having it out in the world, and I think that I've been appreciative of the way that it's been received so far.
Since you bring up personal stories and these college students that you talk to in the interviews and different cities, can we talk about the different cities? We don't necessarily have to talk about the schools, but why you went to New York, Boston, schools in the Northeast, where you went, other schools in different regions, Chicago, right? Mm-hmm. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah. I think I started the study in Chicago. I did my PhD work in Chicago, so it's kind of a You know, I was in the neighborhood, I was in the city. But then also, right, the study began when I got word of an anonymous website that allowed people to post racist things on a college campus without their names being attached. And the website was unique because you had to be a student to post to it. So instead of this just being some random racism online, which people who use the internet get accustomed to ignoring, this is racism that is coming from your peers. You just don't know which one. And so I think that is how the study began, is me really wanting to talk with students about, you know, that website and if it changed the way they thought about race. So expanding it to other places, right? It was because I wanted to make sure that the things I found in Chicago were not just limited to Chicago. And so I sought to find places that were, you know, that were different. In Atlanta, I went to a school that has so I think the school I was at in Chicago had, it's predominantly white. It's a private elite institution. In Atlanta, I went to a school that was more diverse with a bigger population of black folks. In Los Angeles, I went to a school that was a Hispanic serving institution. In New York and Boston, those are both private schools that I went to, but then a very different, kind of urban context than Chicago with different histories of race relations and so on. And so really, right, by going across the country in that way, I'm hoping to tell a story that, right, like I'm hoping to show that the things that I found in one city were not limited to that city. And while there were differences across campuses, for the most part, with the questions that I'm asking about the differences between the online and the digital, that students in all five locations had similar stories of how things online may look differently than things in person do.
So you also mentioned your own personal stories from starting with the discussion of gaming, and also when you yourself you're essentially teaching as a professor. I think this is one of your stories from Boston where you're a professor and you receive this email, a campus alert about the suspect with a dark complexion. Tell us a little bit about that story and how it unfolds.
Yeah. So I think I got an email. Well, so, you know, first of all, when I was in Boston, I taught at Boston University for 4 years. And I would ride my bike to work every day. So I had a bright or kind of a burnt orange backpack that would fit to my bike. So it was kind of like it was a bag I bought that was a biking backpack, you know, specifically. And I got an email as I'm leaving work one day saying that a suspect with dark skin with an orange backpack was seen riding his bike away from a stabbing on the on the Boston University medical campus. And I just kind of looked down on myself. I'm like, okay, I have darker skin. I am on a bike and I have an orange backpack. And today it might not be safe for me to be seen with these things on campus where there was just a violent attack with someone who matches my description. So I left my bike in the office. I left my backpack in the office. I was going to do some work in the evening, but I decided, I guess I'll just relax this evening and leave my work here and get back to it in the morning because I just didn't want to put myself in danger. Right. So it's just this idea of, right, so this is not a indictment of Boston University specifically, but I think at every university I've been a part of, there are, you know, we get campus emails all the time telling you about incidents and oftentimes the way people are described in terms of skin color, this may apply to every black person on campus. And I think the black men who get these emails saying, hey, a black man between the height of 5'7" and 6'2", between the age of 18 and 35 has been seen doing such and such, and everybody becomes a potential suspect in those ways. So that's definitely right. I definitely feel like I am not immune to being, to experiencing racism. And I think part of the purpose of me telling some of these stories is to show how racism works in a society where racism is no longer the law of the land. Right. That black folks, there are no signs on college campuses that say no black people allowed, but black people often feel unwelcome or unsafe on college campuses when they are seen or treated as outsiders. right? When, right, I tell some other stories about being asked for my ID, right, when I'm on campus, and you know, spaces where I should not have been by people who should not have been asking me. And it's right. It's a strange feeling that makes you feel like, oh, I have not, I'm not really accepted here, despite the open rhetoric and despite them wanting to take a picture of me to put on a website, that they're looking at me as an outsider and they want to check to make sure that I have the credentials. And so I think that that's an experience that is shared by many, you know, Black students across the country. These are things that came out of my interviews, but also I also know just from having networks of you know, Black friends and family who have had negative experiences on campuses. So again, so like, what is the point of telling those stories? Is to show what does racism look like? Today, and how might that be different online when people, right, when you have kind of more willingness online for people to say things about race that they don't say in person. I think that the chapter that where I'm talking about these kind of on-campus microaggressions, talking about responses to racism and how do we respond, and how difficult it is to respond to subtle forms of racism where we don't even really know if racism was behind it in person, as opposed to online when you have a community behind you who can really make explicit what type of racism is taking place, and then challenging that point of view as being problematic as opposed to being acceptable.
You know, you're more hopeful than I am. And I'm glad that you are, because I need hope. And it just thinking about how all of these people, you know, your point in the book, one of your points in the book anyway, is about how social media and the digital age can really expose the racism and reveal it to people. And it makes me think back to George Floyd's murder, where the world was forced to watch that man have his neck crushed and die in front of them. And the world was outraged, took to the streets, and folks said, oh, we're going to change, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. But the backlash to it was brutal, punctuated with the most recent, you know, Supreme Court decision on affirmative action.
That's right.
So that's why, you know, I feel the hope, but I still just... You got to convince me.
Yeah. No. That's real. That's real. And I think that for me, the way that I think about and discuss hope is not naive, right? I'm not hopeful in a way that I think that we are going to be a colorblind society. I'm hopeful that the more people who see racism, the more people we will be able to recruit to help us fight against racism. And that does not mean I think that the racist, you know, like the strength of white supremacy is gone. I think that there will be a fight. I'm just hopeful that we are going to, you know, to be able to continue the fight. I'm hopeful when I see people fighting in ways that I had not thought of, that I'm hopeful to be able to learn from the new experts, the new people who are taking part in this fight. And so, you know, with things like the Supreme Court decision, right, we knew that the court was stacked, against, or kind of, you know, for conservatives, and, you know, affirmative action. It's not surprising that you know, a lot of people today don't understand why we need affirmative action. That the dominant way of thinking about, you know, race in the U.S. is to think about it in individual terms, not thinking about history, that history has nothing to do with me. I didn't enslave anyone. So why should I have to pay for what happened to someone else? Or it's been, you know, like Black people have been able to vote for X number of years. So why are they still struggling? And kind of this, like, what's invisible to people are the ways that you know, whites have been privileged by policies and Black folks have been hurt by policies. And what's visible to them is that they see how hard they've worked and don't want what they have to be taken away from them. So I think a decision like the affirmative action decision is not surprising when you think about how, and, you know, most people think about racism in simplistic terms. They think it just means people who say, I hate Black people, I want Mexicans to go back to Mexico. And if you don't say those things, then you're not considered racist. And I think that, right, that's part of the dialogue I want to engage in, is to help educate people about the systemic you know, nature of racism, that racism is about how structures hurt the life chances of folks of color. And so that, right, like when we have a more complex understanding of racism, then we can have a more complex understanding of the types of policies that are needed to fight against it, things like affirmative action. So, right, I think that I do remain hopeful that we are engaging more and more people in those conversations. I am discouraged, of course, when I see that decision. I am discouraged when you have states making laws that's going to make it harder for people to get access to the type of knowledge I'm talking about, of having a complex understanding of racism, as opposed to taking us back a couple generations to believe, you know, people talking about slavery being good for Black folks, right? Like, these are some crazy things that are you know, can potentially be the norm in schools. And so I think that, right, it is our job to increase people's understanding of how racism works in order to, you know, recruit them to taking action against racism.
No, it certainly exposes it. And when you see something like what happened to George Floyd happen, you can't, it's undeniable, even mm-hmm. though folks look at the video and they attempt to, it's just, you know, a number of folks who attempt to do that, but you have to confront it and say, hey, I'm not that person. I don't want to be that person. You know, I think video can be a very powerful tool in memes and in terms of the way that resistance has taken place by young people, which is that second part of your book where you talk about the different ways that these young people on these campuses and beyond organize around hashtags, memes, Black Twitter. You know, the book is power-packed with so much, I think, for us to sort of digest. And one of the phrases I want you to talk, well, I want us to talk about digital resistance, but I also want, let's talk a little bit about that phrase, kind of a play on the Du Bois idea of double consciousness, mm-hmm. Double-sided consciousness. Mm-hmm. Talk to us about that a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. So double consciousness from Du Bois is this idea that it is about the ways that experiencing racism in a society as Black folks and understanding the way the white world works, but then also understanding that we are separate and excluded, right? Understanding the way the white folks think about us creates this phenomenon called double consciousness, where it's like we are unable to maintain a single self-consciousness because we see ourselves as we are and we see ourselves as white folks see us. So it's this idea that the knowledge of or understanding of white prejudice hurts us on a psychic or psychological, emotional, spiritual level. And so what I do in chapter 6, I talk about, I introduce a term called double-sided consciousness. And I talk about how online, you know, Black folks and folks of color engage in a challenging of white ideas about race and a naming of what white racism and prejudice looks like that externalizes that problem and creates a double-sided consciousness where you're introducing the world to what it, you know, to what racism looks like from the perspective of Black folks in a way that I think is cathartic and that can be a potential solution to the double consciousness problem, which, you know, 100 years after Du Bois remains, you know, unsolved. And so that is, right, I do a case study of the word white people, which is just a creative spelling for white people, and really investigate how, you know, this is something that originated with Black Twitter, but has, you know, is now being used by other groups of color, and just kind of this terminology, you know, being used in lighthearted ways and not necessarily explicitly engage in resistance, but is an excellent example of what resistance online looks like as you have this collective communal action that challenges dominant, you know, understandings and rejects this idea that Black folk and folks of color need to be hurt and damaged by the way white people think about us.
And that brings us to resistance and Black Twitter and whether or not Black Twitter is going to survive X, but that's probably another show too. But
yeah, yeah. You know, I think Black Twitter is going to survive X. And even if that means it has to move, I think that, you know, Black Twitter is not just the coding, it's the people, it's the community. I don't think that, I think that we have seen some evidence of algorithms being biased against Black folks. And I think that there is potential for, you know, Twitter or X to be intentional about gatekeeping access to the public for Black influencers or making it harder for Black folks to talk to each other. You know, but there's a financial incentive for them to not do that, right? The biggest hashtag, the most used hashtag ever is Black Lives Matter, right? That there's advertising revenue to be made off of Black folks going viral on Twitter. So I don't know that, right? So we'll see whether racist, you know, intent is more powerful than capitalist greed. I don't know. I feel like that, you know, capitalism may win out there, even if there is going to be some bias built in. But I believe Black Twitter will remain. And I think that, you know, before there was Black Twitter, there were Black blogs. Black Planet, right? The Black folks have been finding ways to use technology to find each other and to engage in meaningful discussions for a long time. I'm not worried about where we will go next. I think that we will, I think that we will find our way.
Sure. As a liberatory power of technology gets into, you know, other conversations too, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. And even when you talk about, right, you're talking about like that, what is the power of video? One of the things I talk about in the book is that during the civil rights movement, organizers and activists had to plead for news stations to cover their stories. And they knew that when those videos got out of dogs attacking, you know, innocent people and people being sprayed with the hoses, that the American public would not like it. It made us look bad in front of Russia. It made Americans feel like this is not right. This is not the America that I believe in. And what are we doing to our Black citizens? And that helped the struggle. But they had to get past the media gatekeepers to get those stories to be told in order to, you know, create change in people who were watching those horrific acts of violence. And nowadays with social media, that people don't have to plead with mainstream gatekeepers to get it, bring attention to injustices, and that Black folks and Black activists can be as powerful as traditional media outlets and getting that word out. And so I think that is part of the draw, part of the beauty of online resistance, is that you don't have to listen or wait for the permission of an institutional gatekeeper. You can go and do it yourself. You can build that community and get in touch with the community on your own and independently. Now, again, it remains to be seen to what extent these social media companies are going to become the new gatekeepers. And there is some evidence that they've already started that process. But then I think that in general, right, that is, has been one of the beauties of social media activism, is that people don't have to rely on other folks to tell their stories, and that the activists can tell their own stories.
Sure. The idea of the I reporter, right, where you are your own reporter. And if you look at the history of the civil rights movement, the use of TV, television, journalism, on the spot reporting began in 57. Right at Central High School with the Little Rock Nine, where on the spot reporting, hey, we have this live event happening. Let me run over there and see what's going on. And now today you have iReporting, where, you know, news programs say, send in your report of the snow, how much snow did your town get? You know, that kind of thing. And using the handheld video camera, the phone camera and so on.
Right.
So I see your hope. I see the hope that you're pointing to. And it's kind of funny though, because now I'm just starting to think of the Karen. Nobody wants to be branded a Karen, right? And where did that come from? Recording these women who are outrageous on video and posting it to Twitter, and everyone's, oh, I don't want to be a Karen. What do you mean a Karen?
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah. No, that's a great example of it, right? That it's exposing the type of racism that people typically get away with. That usually you have Black folks who tell the story of how they are getting harassed, but they can't do anything about it. And then when it gets posted online, now all of a sudden being harassed, right, or being the harasser, you feel a little bit less power when that camera gets in your face, because now the person who you had the power to stop this Black person from enjoying their barbecue, you had the power to stop these kids from selling lemonade, you had the power to stop this man from bird watching. But the next day when that thing goes viral, now you have a power shift where you may lose your job. You may lose the support of family members and colleagues and friends who see the ugliness of racism on full display. Whereas, right, that can be explained away as like, no, I'm just protecting my neighborhood. But when you see the video and you see that this is a, you know, this is a conversation you would never have with white folks. Why are you, why do you feel like that you have the right to police black behavior in this public space? Mm-hmm. That changes things a little bit, right? So that is one of the many examples of how online resistance looks a little bit different and makes us feel better, makes us feel like we can give, you know, we have the ability to share stories that, you know, before the advent of social media, were largely only shared in private, you know, spaces where we felt comfortable with our, you know, with our community. And now we're sharing them with the public and letting the world see what that looks like.
I want somebody to analyze the confessions of the Karens, right? Mm-hmm. But what these women who run away and say, oh, I don't, and the next day they're crying, I'm not a racist, I did it. You know, and I want, like, just those confessionals after they've been exposed would make, I think, a very interesting, you know, analysis. Like, what, like, the Karen a month later, right? Is she...
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I wonder, is this,
you know, I think that what you're right. And this relates to some of the things I talk about. And when the hood comes off is I tell stories of folks, white folks making racist jokes online. And when they're challenged, being able to explain them away. Right. I tell the story of a white student who posted a picture of a black dining hall worker reading a book. And just laughing at it as if this is a, you know, this doesn't make sense for a black man to be reading, black working class man to be reading. And mm-hmm. it was that joke was explained away when the student was challenged. He said, oh, no, this is not about race. You're making it about race. And that is a script that we hear all the time. It's saying, oh, no, that wasn't racist. You're racist for thinking that I'm racist. And online, mm-hmm. those types of excuses are less believable. In part because you're not right. People are not alone when they're challenging you, that they're in a community. And so you have more people who are saying, no, this is racist and here's why it's racist. And then now, right, like you, right, this is why you have people crying saying, oh, no, I'm not racist, because that type of racist behavior has been acceptable because it's easy to explain away. I'm not racist. I just didn't recognize you as my neighbor. So I wanted to double check what you were doing here because I care about my neighborhood. But when you see it online, you play it back, and then you get thousands, millions of people who are saying, oh, yeah, that was racist. Now, right, like you can't, you right, that's when you turn to the tears because you're caught. And right, like you may not even have felt like you were being racist, but when you look back at the video, it's hard to frame it in a different way.
Sure. Absolutely. And it's, we're running out of time here, but the intersections, right, of class, race, and all of these things, it makes me think about the man who sprayed the homeless man in front of his store with the water hose. Mm. And it was caught, and he's like, oh, I didn't do it. You know, I told him several times not to sit in front of my store. And people, when they saw that, they were outraged. Like, how dare you?
Yeah.
You know, do something like this.
Yeah.
It was hard for him to live that down.
Yeah. And, but you know, it's interesting that like you'll see the, like people will, that's how they react to the video. But, you know, you see it institutionalized in policies, like, right, like kind of places where there are bumps built into the architecture to prevent people from sleeping in a certain place. Right. I think that you have city planning that is built around how do we keep homeless people from using this space? And it's just a right. It tells us something about society when we're planning to stop people from being able to sleep in the public space instead of planning on how do we provide housing for folks who would want to sleep in this public space. And, you know, and so it's the type of thing that is a socially acceptable policy to try and prevent folks from sleeping. But then the right when you actually see the human side of that act, then you have more people who are on the side of like of seeing that as being something that is immoral and that they would prefer to find, you know, different solutions.
I think it's so when you talk about the architecture piece, it makes me think about Jersey Shore area and some of these small towns that purposely don't have any sidewalks. Mm. You know, we want to make sure these poor folks who may need to take the bus, they can walk in the road and die or not come through my little patch of land.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. You know, it's a sad and scary thing. I think, right, that song that just came out about, you know, not in my small town, or try that in a small town.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you compare that to, okay, yeah, black man trying to jog in a small town. What happens? And right, like that, right, like this, right. These ideas you're talking about, you know, can turn to death. And I think that, you know, it's important for us to make those connections in order to challenge the idea that things like that song can be, consumed without us being able to have a conversation about race.
Yeah. The idea that a man could essentially sing about lynching and what could happen to a black mm-hmm. person in a small, mm-hmm. It was just stunning that in this day and age, you know, the year is 2023, yeah. not 1923, but. Professor, right. Let me give you the right. last word here as we wrap things up, and give us your final thoughts about a most excellent book, When the Hood Comes Off.
Thank you so much. Look, I appreciate you taking the time to read it and have a conversation with me. You know, it's wonderful to be here. If folks are interested in following along with, with my work, or want to chat about the book, you can find me on my website, robeshman.com. I'm on Twitter at Rob Eshman, and I'm on Instagram at rob.eshman.
Thank you so much, Professor, for joining us today on Black in Boston and Beyond. Thank you.